Robin Hood Radio and the Robin Hood Radio Network is proud to present Leonard Lopate at Large, lively hour-long in-depth discussions providing overviews and context to topics usually covered in partial measures. His guests include leading thinkers, scientists, artists, economists, farmers, historians, authors, and politicians. Mr. Lopate is a Peabody Award winner whose numerous honors include 3 Associated Press Awards and 3 James Beard Awards.
Welcome to Leonard Lopate at Large. I'm Leonard Lopate. The Seward Park Urban Renewal Area, called Spura, is a section of the Lower East Side that stretches from Delancey and Essex Streets to the entrance of the Williamsburg Bridge. In 1967, 1,800 families in the area were displaced from their homes with a promise that they could return after New York City replaced their aging tenement buildings with new affordable housing. Over the next 50 years, development stalled, lawsuits multiplied, and people argued over their visions for the site. Spur is now being rebuilt as a planned mixed-use development called Essex Crossing. And joining us now to help us understand this complex and largely untold story is Gabrielle Bendina-Viani, the head of a design and research studio called Buscada. She is a professor of urban studies and public art at the New School and the author of a new book from the University of Iowa Press called Contested City, Art and Public History as Mediation at New York Seward Park Urban Renewal Area. And I'm very pleased to welcome her to our show. Hi.
Thanks for having me.
When did large-scale urban renewal projects like this start in New York City?
Well, large-scale urban renewal was really aided by several different housing bills started from the mid-40s onward, and a lot of them really started to come to fruition in the early 50s. So Spura was that period was 1967 and was really the tail end of urban renewal.
But hadn't there already been calls for projects of this sort or even events? For example, social reformers like Jacob Riis advocated for the demolition of degraded areas in New York in the late 19th century, and Central Park involved displacing people from their homes to build the park.
Absolutely. We have a long and
Lincoln Center is another case?
Right. Lincoln Center actually is an example of urban renewal. And so where basically what is now seen as eminent domain was used to demolish buildings to build something sort of for the public good. But it was part of that urban renewal scheme.
Well, most people wouldn't want to knock down Lincoln Center. But what is the downside of urban renewal?
Sure. I mean, and this is the complicated part of thinking about urban renewal. So Lincoln Center is a good example. Lots of other kinds of, either highway systems or other kinds of infrastructure that we see as kind of part of New York City now is really part and parcel of some of those same tools of urban renewal. One of the things that urban renewal really did do was that though some of the things that got built were very beneficial to the city, the process by which it got built was incredibly painful, and also that pain was unequally felt.
So do we tend to minimize the emotional toll of displacement?
Absolutely, absolutely. And there's been a lot of work on that, and for a long period of time, both in the United States and internationally, where there have been many examples of ways in which people have been displaced from their neighborhoods, either because they were promised that they would be able to move somewhere better somewhere else, but not really taking into account the kinds of social connections that people really have in their neighborhoods.
Isn't there often a racial dimension to urban renewal? Some have called it minority removal.
Absolutely. So there's a real reason why at the time it was referred to as either Negro removal. People referred to it as in that context and talked about and when they were trying to really build a sense of activism around what was so problematic about urban renewal was that the people whose neighborhoods were targeted were often people of color, and so that there were ways in which those were neighborhoods that were deemed as blighted. That was part of the way in which urban renewal kind of is characterized. And so it's often not just sort of talking about the buildings, but this underlying social subtext was talking about kind of denigrating people themselves.
Lincoln Center is one of those areas.
Certainly, certainly, it was
mostly an African American neighborhood. Thelonious Monk grew up there.
Mm-hmm. Yep, African American and Puerto Rican, and actually some of the kind of the narrative of West Side Story is actually based on some of the parts of that neighborhood that was there before.
The area we're discussing is a sub-neighborhood of the Lower East Side. 14 square blocks, never really had a name.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Was it given Seward Park that name because of the high school?
It is near Seward Park, the park, and also near the high school. And it was the Seward Park Urban Renewal Area was named that when they were naming the Urban Renewal Area. I don't think, in all my kind of research, I've never heard anyone refer to that particular area as prior to the Urban Renewal having a name, but people did refer to it as kind of having a feeling.
If it had been named later, it would be Sodell, exactly. South of Delancey.
Exactly.
Or EX, east of Essex.
It still could be.
Was New York City's Lower East Side ever anything except a lower-class workers' neighborhood?
Not in any recent memory, no. It's really been, but the mixture of people really has been shifting and ebbing and changing for a very long time. But that history is really deep within the Lower East Side.
And who was living in this area, the area that is covered by the acronym SPURA, mm-hmm. for Seward Park Urban Renewal Area?
By 1967, the population was a mixture of Puerto Rican families. That was the majority of families who were there, but it was actually an incredibly deeply mixed neighborhood, which many people talk about as part of what was so extraordinary and what they really deeply miss about the neighborhood as well. So there was a large number of Puerto Rican families. There were African American families. There were Jewish families often who had been Holocaust refugees. There were other white families that had been maybe more recent immigrants from Europe post-World War II. There was a smaller number of Asian families, but you really had this very diverse group of people.
Asians, because Chinatown mm-hmm. is an adjacent neighborhood.
Absolutely.
But a lot of people associate the area with the Jewish immigrants who moved there from Eastern Europe. The 19th century, and then as a result of the Holocaust, had they already kind of moved out by the time we're talking?
Some families certainly had, particularly families who had been there, some from immigration more around the turn of the century. I think one of the things that characterized this area by 67, this particular sort of 14 square block area, was that it was really more recent immigrants from of wide variety of places, including immigration, although that's not really immigration, but migration from Puerto Rico.
What was the condition of the tenement apartment stock in Spur at the time?
Certainly had been, if it was bad when Jacob Riis looked at it, there hadn't been great improvements over time. Very many of the people who were living in Seward Park tenements were kind of experiencing the same things that people 20 and 30 years had been living with and had been out of. There was often still shared bathrooms. There were often, lots of kind of problematic heating and water and all of those kinds of things. So these tenements were in very rough shape. They often hadn't been greatly improved.
And you quote a tenant describing a walk-up apartment as having no refrigerator, no heat, no hot water.
Absolutely.
Sounds like NYCHA housing today, right? In some cases, unfortunately.
Right.
But so when people speak of this as a special neighborhood, is that just nostalgia speaking?
I think that's really an interesting question, and it's something I struggled with a lot when I was thinking about the project and in interviewing people about their experiences. And one of the things that's interesting to see to play out is how there's this balance of both. And I think also kind of is telling about why people, in fact, did leave Spurra, right? Why people did say, okay, you're going to promise to build new housing. Okay, we'll be willing to go if we can have new housing, right? The people didn't sort of advocate as maybe strongly as they might have, because there was a real housing problem with the quality of the housing. So there's this real tension both between the quality of the housing and people wanting, a functional house. Of course people want that. And also feeling like they had a real strong sense of relationships with their neighbors. And I think people can kind of hold both of those things in their minds at the same time. There's actually been quite a bit of other research around this, kind of both around the time of urban renewal when it was popular, both in the United all across the United States. Particularly, there was some research done in the West End of Boston where people were talking about their the demolition of their neighborhood. Though they wanted better housing, they also felt like watching their houses being demolished was like experiencing loss and grief.
And into the story comes Robert Moses, one of the most controversial figures in the history of our area. I can't just say the city, because also Long Island.
Certainly.
He played a major role in some very negative things and some very positive things. Among his many jobs, didn't he lead the Slum Clearance Committee?
Absolutely. And the Slum Clearance Committee was really kind of the central committee that worked around urban renewal in New York City. He had a lot of unelected hats, though, that he wore.
He gave us bridges. He gave us Riverside Park.
Absolutely.
And he also tried to destroy the Soho area. People fought against that.
Right. And one of the things that is most fascinating about Spurra is almost like you see multiple Robert Moses projects or imagined projects kind of coming together in collision there, because the Lower Manhattan Expressway that was supposed to cut across, come across Delancey and Broome off the Williamsburg Bridge was supposed to cut into a section of Spurra, which, you know, would have, you know, if it didn't get demolished for the urban renewal and the sort of building of new housing, it would have been demolished for parts of this highway.
So was that the original impetus for doing all of this, the Robert Moses's Lower Manhattan Expressway?
It was supposed to cut into a chunk of Spurra, but not the whole thing. So the idea of at some point, although
it was it saved because of all the opposition to destroying Soho?
Well, those things were kind of happening in parallel to each other. So Spurra itself went on to be demolished, but one of the reasons it seems that they didn't actually have a sponsor to build the buildings, the promised housing that was supposed to be there, was in part because of the kind of uncertainty that the Lower Manhattan Expressway, the potential of it being built, really kind of added to Spurra. So though it was demolished, and the expressway is never built, you know, kind of there's that sort of hovering fear of the expressway that definitely plays a role in thinking about Spurra.
New York City was responsible for tearing down the sites, wasn't it? But as you say, they usually had a sponsor.
Mm-hmm.
Why did the city proceed with tearing down Spurra after the sponsor withdrew? And who was the sponsor?
That is one question that I still feels extremely difficult to understand, is why the demolitions actually went ahead. But the sponsor was originally the United Housing Federation, which built many, many limited equity co-ops around the city, used urban renewal in many senses across the city, in the Bronx and the Lower East Side, many other places, to build often low and moderate income housing. So there's this tension there in thinking about urban renewal as a tool, because in many ways it did result in affordable housing. But there are many questions about why they pulled out, right? Sort of questions about whether LOMAX, this Lower Manhattan Expressway, made it untenable to build there. Also kind of questions about the tail end of urban renewal in 65, and people were really noticing what had happened and the kind of pain that urban renewal had wrought. So there was a turning tide at that time. So they pulled out as sponsors, but then the city did in fact go ahead with demolition.
And Spurra had been declared an urban renewal site in 1967.
Mm-hmm.
Was that a decision of the city council?
Mm-hmm. That's right. That's right.
And the mayor was John Lindsay.
That's right.
Did he play any role in any of this that we know of?
Not more than I think any of the other urban renewal sites particularly. But it was there's a city council meeting notes, which I've looked at and I found actually incredibly moving to see the kind of motion in which they decided that, yes, this was a site that was blighted and should be slated for urban renewal.
I'm speaking to Gabrielle Bendina Viani, who's written a book about the topic we're discussing called, with a very long title actually, Contested City, Art and Public History as Mediation at New York's Seward Park Urban Renewal Area. This is Leonard Lopate at Large on WBAI 99.5 FM in New York. How many families were evicted as a result of Spur?
So approximately we have about 1,850 families that were evicted.
Do we know their ethnicities?
So we do, actually, because of a later lawsuit, which was brought against the New York City Housing Authority. So we actually have their ethnicity and sort of that breakdown that I had described around kind of Puerto Rican, African-American, Jewish, and Asian, that you have that. But you have it actually very well noted from the time because it was actually used in legal documents that were based on class action lawsuits that were brought against some of the buildings that were actually once one of the small number of buildings that were actually built on the site.
How much did the city pay them to cover their moving expenses?
It appears to really range, but many people talked about saying that they were giving maybe 2 to 3 weeks' notice. Most of, you know, these are people who are renters. They didn't own their apartments. And most people were given 2 to 3 weeks' notice and often given somewhere around $150, maybe $300 to move.
It's really hard to move for that little amount. I'm correct. Sure even in 1967 it was hard to find a mover who would do that.
Absolutely. And to kind of uproot
so
your whole life.
So they were really
life.
Being evicted.
Absolutely.
And told, well, tough luck.
That's right. There were some efforts at relocation. There is a relocation. There's a Department of Relocation that New York City actually was fairly new at the time. So people did try to help people place people in new apartments, but it was very uneven.
And do we know where they usually move to?
There's a really wide range of where people ended up. Many people wanted to stay on the Lower East Side. That was the most important thing to them. So
Well, the kids were going to school there.
Exactly.
They often worked in the area.
Absolutely, or their extended family. So very many people ended up doubled up with their extended families. So you ended up with many people in one apartment, maybe that wasn't at Spurra, but was a few blocks away because it was very important for people to stay in the neighborhood. But other people ended up, you know, moving to Brooklyn or to the Bronx. It really ranged. But many people, even though people ended up moving far away, lots of those people really retained connections to the Lower East Side.
And weren't they assured that relocation would be temporary and promised a right to return?
Absolutely, absolutely. And that's part of kind of the reason why I think many people left is that there was a pretty clear description of what would be built there and that they were promised this right to return.
And the city built two buildings, the New York City Housing Authority, mm-hmm. NYCHA, in the 1970s. Did they include affordable units?
So those two were, they're called the Seward Park Extension buildings, and they were fully affordable. They're public housing buildings. They're some of the last public housing buildings, actually, that were built in New York City. So they were affordable, and also all of the people who had been displaced were invited to come back and apply for those apartments. They were supposed to have the priority to those apartments.
And I'm assuming most of them did.
Many people turned up to the rental office, and many people were told, I'm sorry, they're already rented.
How did it become apparent that families of color were being turned away?
People eventually started to notice that it wasn't possible that so many people were being turned away, that people would turn up and say, you know, how is it possible that you know, the family before me just got an apartment and yet somehow I'm not getting an apartment here. I have priority. I can prove it. So people started to notice, and there were several different organizing groups that kind of came out of this to say, wait a minute, we have to take action around this. So it was noticed that families of color very disproportionately were not getting apartments.
And do we know who instituted that policy?
Well, we know
it was obviously de facto rather than official.
Well, we actually think it might have been more official than de facto, because we think it was the New York City Housing Authority, because in subsequent arguments that they made in the class action lawsuits that were brought against them, they eventually ended up making arguments that there were other residents of other public housing developments who should be given deeper priority, kind of going in contrast and contradiction to everything else that had been promised before.
And some were moved from other public housing projects in order to be closer to their synagogues.
That's right.
Isn't it illegal to use religion as a basis for priority?
It absolutely is. Yes. And that really was the baseline for the first round of these class action lawsuits that were brought against NYCHA.
And how did the courts decide?
In the first round, the courts found that they had absolutely been, that there was in violation of the Constitution, for basing people's access to housing based on religion is completely unconstitutional.
But did that affect anything?
No, because
the people were already moved in, and that was the way it was.
People had not quite yet moved in, but people had been promised apartments, and so those apartments ended up being in limbo because the lawsuit continued because there was an appeal brought. And later on in the appeals court process, NYCHA sort of switched its tactic of arguing why this discriminatory filling of these apartments had been acceptable. And they switched from saying, we need to give priority to people because of their synagogue, to we need to protect the neighborhood because there's a concept of tipping points. And that if we let the number of people of color who want to move in here, who are the people who are in fact displaced from this site, then we will end up with a tipping of the neighborhood and that it will trigger white flight. So they relied on a kind of deeply racist pseudoscience of tipping to argue the case.
Sociologists had come up with the idea of the tipping point concept. Mm-hmm. But it's partly based on fact. On the other hand, does that mean that people of color should not be given housing?
Right.
Because some white people might be prejudiced and move away.
Exactly. To think that kind of white discomfort is what we should base housing policy on is a completely ludicrous idea.
And I'm assuming that decision exacerbated tensions between white residents and residents of color.
Absolutely. All of the conversations around this period, so this is the early 70s, 73, were incredibly racially based. In the media at the time, they talked about kind of all of the headlines were Puerto Ricans win, Jews lose. It was incredibly kind of hyped up around the kind of racial quality of this whole argument.
One of your chapters is titled "In the Same Room Without Screaming." Does that evoke the situation at the time?
It seems like that's evoked the situation kind of for the last 40 years, actually, of what does it take to get people to be in the same room without screaming at each other? Because really, Spura has been this very deep flashpoint for many of the biggest issues that have really plagued the United States and American cities kind of in the post-war period.
But why is it dragged on so long? I understand. So people go to court. There were lawsuits and appeals, and there were community activists
eventually
working.
There was a settlement. Eventually those buildings were filled. They were filled on a racial quota system. Actually, that was what the settlement was. You have community activists.
Is that legal, a racial quota system?
Not anymore, but it was at the time, right? Which is sort of further makes the shocking aspects kind of keep coming. You know, one of the things that was so powerful was that, discrimination housing certainly is not new, and it certainly wasn't anything that was unusual to Spura. Spura really is a great example of what was happening in many other developments across the city.
Wait a minute. We understand discrimination in housing if it's a privately owned building. Mm-hmm. But we're talking about buildings that the city was providing to its own residents.
Sure. It's not legal in either one, but That's really kind of one of the crux of this. And it wasn't actually that uncommon. Lots of both affordable and public housing at the time and a little earlier were quite segregated and intentionally segregated. So that language is not special to Spurra.
Meanwhile, before the buildings went up, what was the land that had...
What had been there?
Yeah.
It was 14 square blocks of tenement buildings. So many of the, we're talking about...
Turned into parking lots, weren't they?
Certainly. So they were originally tenements. As those tenements were torn down, they were torn down sort of piecemeal. So people sort of could watch, even after they were displaced from their houses, people sort of could watch their buildings, their old buildings, really kind of crumbling just from decay, really just crumbling because nobody was inhabiting them. And that was painful in and of itself. So once those buildings were torn down, you ended up with this really patchwork landscape so you had some apartment towers that were built, so the two NYCHA buildings and a few more buildings that were built on Grand Street. But the rest of it really became parking lots. And you had this very uneven and sort of very strange landscape that evolved.
Because so much time passed, nearly 50 years, how did the city and the neighborhood change over that time?
It changed incredibly, of course, right? We think about the Lower East Side now, and we think about, we think about kind of the hippest bars and kind of a lot of...
Now art really galleries are moving art, down there again.
Absolutely, right? And you have kind of you have both that and also really radically large development that's happening, not just at Essex Crossing and kind of former Spurra, but near the Manhattan Bridge, all of those towers that are rising on the waterfront. So that's kind of the Lower East Side that's going on right now, right? And we think about kind of what tensions that brings us. But earlier in 67, we have an area that people could argue was blighted, blighted enough to be torn down.
Do you think that was a reasonable argument?
That it was blighted?
Is the issue here that this was a blighted area that needed to be improved, but that what finally wound up happening was not what we would have hoped for?
I think it's hard to say. One of the things is that, the buildings that are, say on Orchard Street, they're the same buildings, right? They just happen to not have been torn down. So those buildings now, because many of these have been, not all, renovated, are, being rented for thousands of dollars, right? So there's this kind of question about, is it the quality of the buildings or is it the quality of care that was actually taken of the housing that was there, in part because who was occupying the housing? So that's where you kind of come back to thinking about urban renewal as really kind of a denigration of people rather than of the buildings themselves.
So this was a landlord issue in many cases.
Certainly, I mean.
People just not keeping up their buildings. Did they have good excuses? Was it that they were being charged the real estate taxes were too high?
I don't think so. I think it was
these weren't rent controlled apartments,
were they? Get away with it. No, but these were spaces that people could get away with it, right? Because if you're willing to sort of denigrate a whole neighborhood, you're willing to overlook whatever the quality of the conditions are.
And you're also working with immigrants. Mm-hmm. Weren't there a number of competing proposals for the space, from subsidized low-income housing to a shopping mall and also office space with no housing?
Absolutely. So over the 40 years, there were many, many proposals for the site. And there were many people who worked very strongly to advocate for affordable housing over that course of that whole period. There was an organization called the Joint Planning Council, which eventually kind of morphed into what is now known as SPARC, that kind of has for a very long time and has kind of connected with the Cooper Square Committee, has been advocating for affordable housing on the site. On the other hand, you had proposals that were for a giant mall. You had often proposals that included no housing at all. There's been proposals for mostly luxury housing, all of those things. And very frequently, those proposals, Kind of the plot thickens, because many of those proposals were really pushed forward and sponsored by Sheldon Silver, who was the assembly person at the time.
Now, he was opposed to affordable housing in Spiro.
Absolutely.
Go ahead.
Well, one of the questions is really, it seems to be that one of the things that drove that was kind of a protection of his own power base. And really, one of the things that people talked about was how much he had acted behind the scenes to, not outwardly, but clearly block any of the affordable housing proposals.
How did his arrest in 1994 on federal corruption charges change the dynamics of the situation?
So his arrest, so the federal corruption charges arrest, that really came kind of at the end of the process of this most recent process of planning. So I would say in some ways it didn't... It didn't really shape this particular of what's there now, but I think it did really underscore and make clear to a lot of people how much they had been right and how much he had been a power player in keeping this series of blocks empty for almost 40 years.
Where did you grow up?
I grew up in New York, and I actually spent a lot of time on the Lower East Side. I didn't grow up on the Lower East Side, but I grew up not too far from there. My grandparents on both sides at different times had lived on the Lower East Side, and so I had a lot of connections to the neighborhood. One of the things that was most shocking to me when I first started thinking about Spiro was how I hadn't known the story of what had happened there.
But I assume... at least 3/4 of the people listening right now don't know the story of Spiro. They may know the story of Soho, but they don't know the story of Spiro. And why do you think that is?
Absolutely.
Because Soho was more of a middle-class area?
I think there's definitely...
The same reason that we know about Jane Jacobs,
right.
and the West Village?
Absolutely. And you know, what's interesting is to see where kind of some of Jacobs' advocacy almost like bumps into Spiro. One of the things I've sort of found in the research was even noticing moments where Jacobs was like actually walking through Spiro kind of on the way to or after... actually, after her famous arrest, she was actually in the Spiro area before it was demolished. So one of the things really is how invisible this has been, right?
And how did you discover it?
I was introduced to it by a colleague, Marcy Reeven, who was at the time working at an organization called City Lore on a project called Place Matters. And she... and I had decided to develop a collaboration to think about how to I would teach a class in which I would be collaborating with some community-based organizations and thinking about, you know, what's interesting about that and why that might be a really beneficial thing for both the organization and for students to learn kind of by doing. And she said, you know, I'd love to work with you. It sounds great. But the only thing I have going on right now that could be appropriate is this thing called Spiro. And, you know, I don't know if you want to get involved in that. And I was like, Spiro, I don't know, what's that?
So it was a spur of the moment decision.
It absolutely was. And so we walked from the New School, which is, we were on 12th Street, and we walked from 12th Street to Grand Street. And in the period of time, she kind of gave me the potted history of what had happened with Spiro. And we ended up on the corner of Essex and Grand. And I thought, I've been here a million times before. You just told me this crazy story. How did I not know this history? And I think that's really part of what, you know, spurred me to really care about this place and want to continue working on it and to think about, well, what does that mean that I didn't know about it? What does it mean that in some ways it's been largely invisible outside of the kind of local area that has really been affected? How problematic that is, that we don't really see kind of the devastation that was wrought by kind of the levels of discrimination that were there, the kind of history of urban renewal, kind of the ongoing issues that sometimes we see urban renewal as a past, whereas it's very much part of our present.
I must admit, I've been in that neighborhood many times. What I remember best is the Carvel on the corner.
Yes.
And Kosar's Bagel and Bialy shop, which used to be one of the best in the
city.
But everything else just, unless you were, I guess, a resident, you might have been totally oblivious to.
I think one of the things that I realized being there and kind of how my understanding of it really deepened was the ways in which I had seen parts of the neighborhood, you know, I'd walked past those parking lots many times. But because I didn't understand, I felt that there was something wrong there. I could feel some sort of pain, really. But in some ways, I had largely avoided it because I didn't really understand what it was that had happened there.
So you developed a class at the new school. Did students register for the class? Were they attracted to this topic?
Absolutely. I'm not sure they knew themselves either what they were getting into.
What kinds of backgrounds did they have?
Most of my students, and I taught this class about for 5 years, the vast majority of them were urban studies students, so meaning that they were liberal arts students who had an interest in kind of urban anthropology and doing research about cities, about neighborhoods. But I also had a wide variety of other students who were design students, art students.
From Parsons.
I had some musicians, absolutely. So from all across the new school, I was based at the liberal arts college is called Eugene Lang, and then a lot of students from Parsons, which is the design school.
As I understand it, your students were required to partner with a community developments project. Was the goal to highlight the history of the neighborhood or to influence specific change?
Well, part of what we wanted to do was to think about how, in a pedagogical way, was how students can really learn from partnering and how students can learn from people who are active on the ground. So that was a big piece of it. And then part of it was really understanding together what we might make together and what might be the purpose of that.
You did art exhibits?
So we made art exhibits, absolutely. And our main partners started out as City Lore and an organization called Good Old Lower East Side, or GOLS, who are really preeminent housing activists and activists on the Lower East Side, who have been really important in the fight for Spurra. And so part of what we started to do was really to understand what was the work that they were doing and how could students contribute to it, learn from it, and also kind of make these series of exhibitions that might support it.
What was the reaction of people in the neighborhood to the students' artwork?
So the students all developed a series of exhibitions, and each time they were, you know, using photographs or oral histories or mapping as ways of basically trying to look at what the site was rather than seeing it as kind of developable square feet. It was really to show it as a place. And one of the things that was remarkable to us was that we would get to these kind of openings and people would come. And particularly in the second year, in the third years, some people would look at me and they'd say, "Wait a minute, I haven't ever seen those two people in the same room without screaming at each other." And that really was one of the things, the insights that I took away was for this kind of work.
As in much of New York City, isn't gentrification exerting pressure on the issues surrounding development at the site? The new school isn't all that far away from Spurra. Many of your students knew a lot about the bars and nightlife of the area, which is becoming more and more upscale, than they knew about their own homes and histories.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So, you know, one of the issues really was also sort of introducing students to it as a neighborhood and have kind of letting people and themselves really see the place as a site of histories, a place where people really cared about a site, all of those things to really show kind of what's at stake there, but also even broadly when we think about gentrification, we think about displacement, really what's at stake when we think about people losing their homes.
Are you familiar with the Richard Price novel, Lush Life, which describes a wide range of people who live close to each other on the Lower East Side but don't know each other at all?
I know it a little bit, not deeply, but yes.
In this case, we're talking about a complex community. There are old-timers, newcomers, students who are there temporarily, the sort of thing that we see in a neighborhood where the rents are still kind of affordable. How did the local community board, the CB3, wind up with playing a major role in setting the guidelines for the development of Spur?
Yeah. Well, one of the things, so when we had the kind of initiative that we had joined, that Goals and City Lore were really spearheading with the Pratt Center, was an entity called Spurra Matters. And they had really spurred a lot of community visioning sessions and kind of piggybacked and built together a lot of other community-based work that had been being done with Cooper Square Committee and Spark as well. They'd really been spurring this local conversation from the ground up. And one of the things that really, one of the kind of desires that Goals had for doing these community visioning sessions starting in 2008 was to show that there was willingness on the part of the neighborhood to actually get something built on the site.
Why do you think their efforts succeeded when so many earlier efforts had failed?
I think there are many, many reasons. One of them might actually be, I think this was a new way of dealing with it. I think there was a really radically different way of actually trying to spur that conversation and build broad coalition. It also kind of piggybacked on and tried to jump on the moment where the Bloomberg administration had said they wanted to build, right? They were clearly very pro-developer, but this was also an opportunity to see if the largest underdeveloped site of city-owned land south of 96th Street could actually be developed as part of this.
In the plan, there were guarantees that all affordable units would be affordable into perpetuity.
That sounds right.
Very idealistic. Don't most development plans age out?
They absolutely do. Almost all of them age out, and it's part of the reason that we have an affordable housing crisis at the moment, because many of the largest producers of affordable housing, the sort of biggest moments in time where New York City produced affordable housing, actually have aged out in the last 15 years.
You said that 1,800 families had been displaced initially. Was there an attempt to contact them and tell them that units were available to them?
Yes, absolutely.
How do you do that?
With a lot of difficulty. So one of the things that has been happening, because those affordable units were built, which are in fact affordable in perpetuity, which is like one of the hugest wins of community organizing on the site, was that there have been a lot of basically small groups on the Lower East Side who have help people find, you know, their school records or, hospital records that prove that people had been residents there and have been doing an extraordinary amount of outreach to find those people.
Have many former residents become ineligible because of income requirements?
I think there are certainly some, but there are many who do, in fact, qualify for the income requirements.
The New York Times had a piece on somebody named David Santiago, who was forced out of an apartment on Delancey Street with his family when he was 6 years old, mm-hmm. and is now moving back.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So there have been many people who were children at the time. And are now actually able to move back.
Is the land still owned by New York City?
So it is no longer owned by New York. It's because it was city-owned originally, and I think now part of the whole development process, it is no longer city land. But up until this whole process, it was.
There's been a lottery.
Yes.
How many people entered the lottery for a chance to live in one of the 99 units devoted to senior housing?
Oh, gosh. I honestly cannot remember the number, but it was hundreds of thousands.
60,000 people.
I mean, it's really shocking.
But what do you think of a lottery as a way of determining who'll get affordable housing? Isn't that a rather unfair way of doing things?
Absolutely. between that one and another site, there's been two and maybe now three affordable housing lotteries. So hundreds of thousands of people have applied for just very few spots. And it really points to, again, the kind of crisis in affordable housing. If there's that many people who need it around the city that we have every time, and I think that's pretty standard for every affordable housing lottery around the city, that you have that many people applying.
What are the plans for the new Essex Crossing development? That's the new name being given to this area?
Absolutely. So that's the development. And so the new senior building, which is named after Francis Golden, who is a longtime community activist, actually.
Where would that be located?
So that building is built, and that's on Delancey. That's the farthest east building on the site.
Is the Essex Market threatened in any way?
Essex Street Market, so currently on the north side of Delancey and Essex, is going to be demolished.
Oh,
yeah.
That's a New York treasure.
I know. It is going to be demolished. Part of the negotiations and really deep organizing that happened around that is that Essex Street Market will move into the new development. So the last I heard was that it will be opening in April or May in the new building that's on the south side of Delancey and Essex.
They also have to come up with plans for medical centers, community centers. One of the buildings is named for Sonny Rollins, the great jazz tenor player. What's his connection to the neighborhood?
I don't think he has much of a connection to this particular development.
I mean, he's famous for playing saxophone on the Williamsburg Bridge.
Right. And I think he did live nearby. I think it's a thin connection, perhaps. But it is a great name.
So they've changed the name to Essex Crossing. By changing the name of a neighborhood, don't we erase its history? For example, Hell's Kitchen has become Clinton. Atlantic mm-hmm. Yards is now Pacific Park.
I know. I find that one particularly galling.
Well, you've done work on Atlantic Yards as well.
Absolutely. And this tension around kind of Atlantic Yards, Pacific Park, Spura, Essex Crossing, one of the things that it hides, and particularly at Essex Crossing, is it really hides the kind of activism and the kind of resistance that have been at the heart of this place that is really important. And I can understand why we don't want something to be known as an urban renewal area forever, and yet to kind of completely deny it of that really changes the way that we think about the place.
Atlantic Yards is a large project which is actually located very close to where we're speaking right now,
yes.
Where WBAI is located on Atlantic Avenue. Despite opposition, how is New York State able to exercise eminent domain to seize private property for the economic development project? Do they have to prove an area is blighted?
Yes, and so it really, in the case of Atlantic Yards, it really follows in the footsteps. It's not urban renewal anymore. We don't use that. That particular program is not used anymore. But eminent domain works in very much the same way, although what its uses can be for are broader than what urban renewal was. And so they had to argue both that it was blighted and that it was being built for the public good. There is a pretty broad definition of public good, particularly at Atlantic Yards, just similar to the way that there's a very broad definition of what affordable means in New York, right? We don't have things that actually hold people to account, particularly development to account in really serving the needs of us as citizens of the city. So at Atlantic Yards, the argument was that, you know, a basketball stadium was in the public good, and its accompanying units of housing, which are certainly there are some affordable units, but there are many luxury units there.
Eminent domain is now being proposed as part of the president's plan to mm-hmm. build a wall.
Yes, yes.
And it's interesting that conservatives have often been opposed to eminent domain. Suddenly now they are not. What has been the political side of it in New York City history?
Yeah, I mean, interestingly, right? I mean, eminent domain really is the taking of private property for supposedly some sort of public good. You'd think that would drive conservative people crazy. So it really seems like that would be the thing that would constantly rankle. You know, I think in this context, it really is kind of, well, who is losing, whose private property is being taken, and who is actually benefiting from it. So I think it's the question of following the money more often than anything else.
What kind of work are you doing to make residents aware of the history of their neighborhood prior to the Atlantic Yards project?
Mm-hmm. So this is another project that I've been working on, and this is the kind of work that we do at Buscata a lot, is we really want to think about how can we make history and also sort of personal histories more public so that people really understand their own stake in their own neighborhood. So in Prospect Heights, I had done a lot of research with people about kind of their connection and their relationship to their neighborhood. So the stories that people would tell. And I had done that work in the early 2000s. And in around 2015, in a partnership with Brooklyn Public Library and Prospect Heights Neighborhood Development Council, who have been really trying to hold Atlantic Yards to account, we did a series of public art and interventions all around Prospect Heights to really disseminate these kinds of oral histories and photographs of the neighborhood, but from 10 years previous, as a way to really highlight the kinds of pretty stark gentrification and shifts in the neighborhood that have been happening, as a way to help people basically find a way to talk about that. So as part of that, we made a series of guidebooks that were distributed in supermarkets and bodegas and bars and all kinds of things, and also gave a series of walking tours that the tours themselves became a place for old residents, new residents, displaced residents to come back and sort of read other people's stories, but then have the capacity to share their own.
Getting back to Spura, the International Center of Photography is planning to move there.
Yeah.
Is that one way of giving legitimacy to these kinds of projects, to move a respectable institution? Well, it's in Midtown Manhattan right now and not in the best location.
Sure. So, yeah, ICP... I actually worked at ICP when at the time that they announced this plan. So it was really an interesting experience for me, but my sort of worlds were colliding. One of the things that, so ICP actually moved from its Midtown location and has been on the Bowery, and so has really been looking for this site to kind of bring all of their pieces together. It's really a question about, you know, what can cultural institutions do when they enter a complicated place like this? Can they be a part of making a space that actually helps bring this place together as a future?
Well, you mentioned helping people in the area appreciate and understand the past of their area. Doesn't Lower East Side Tenement Museum work to preserve and interpret the history of immigration and that area?
Absolutely, they do. And I think that's one of the questions is, like, how can they and other cultural institutions really expand that mission to think about, you know, go further into thinking about what is the neighborhood today? What are the kind of the political tensions around questions about basically, you know, there's a lot of political tensions around really the authenticity of the Lower East Side and kind of who it belongs to, who its future belongs to. And those are questions that cultural institutions are really poised to be able to answer. But sometimes sort of struggle with trying to figure out the ways to make that happen.
We're seeing similar situations happening in Harlem, in Bed-Stuy, in the Clinton Hill
Absolutely.
Section of Brooklyn as well. And in all cases, it seems to me, there's a racial component.
Absolutely. And it's one of the things that I really hoped with writing the book is that not so much to only think about Spura because it's this kind of unbelievable history and example, but also to think about the ways in which some of the organizing around Spura and the kind of things that have happened at that site can be useful to many of these other neighborhoods where they're really facing significant tension from large-scale development, facing real racial disparities, and the ways in which we're sort of thinking about our city, that we can look at the history of Spura and try to learn from it, because so many of these things are kind of being played out time and time again.
Gabrielle Bendina Vianney is the head of a design and research studio called Buscada. She's a professor of urban studies and public art at the New School and the author of a book from the University of Iowa Press called Contested City, Art and Public History as Mediation at New York's Seward Park Urban Renewal Area. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
And that brings us to the end of today's show. My great thanks to Gabrielle Bendina Vianney, to Deborah Freeman, who produced this segment, to Reggie Johnson, who was at the audio controls, to Charlie Morrow, who composed our theme music, and to my executive producer, Jesse Lent. Leonard Lopate at Large comes to you on Saturdays at 4 and Tuesdays at noon. You can subscribe to Leonard Lopate at Large podcast on iTunes and by clicking on Robin Hood Radio's archive program site. which is robinhoodradio.com. You can also check out Leonard Lopate at Large Facebook page. We hope to see you next week.